an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The study has revealed that the U.S. has waged 400 wars since its founding, a quarter of them in West Asia and in Africa. What does that say about the founding fathers of the U.S. to present-day leaders? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. has what appears to be war as a doctrine, why it has focused on Africa and West Asia to wage these wars, and why it has not won any wars recently, despite waging so many of them. Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, who joins us from Madison. We also have journalist and author Daniel Lazar joining us from New York. Welcome to you both. Daniel Lazar, I'll start with you. The name of the study, Introducing the Military Intervention Project, a new data set on U.S. military interventions. Well, it sounds with a lot of bells and whistles there. Okay. The U.S. undertook almost 400 military interventions from its founding in 1776 to 2019. It sounds like a lot. The research we did supports the numbers. Then the question comes about, why is the U.S. relying on military interventions in such a way, or executing it, I should say, in such a way?
Well, that's about one intervention every 8 months when you consider the U.S. has been around for about 250 years or so. The U.S. is a state. It's very aggressive. It's violent, like all states are violent. But this violence has certainly exploded since World War II, when the U.S. led the step forth and emerged as the leader of the global crusade against communism. And then it took another leap upwards in 1991, when the Soviet bloc collapsed, the U.S. was the last superpower left standing. So the U.S. Did its best to assert its global hegemony across the world, and that meant a dramatic increase in military conflicts. And then there was yet another increase after 9/11. When the U.S., stepped up its military warfare, and especially with regard to the Middle East, started pouring arms into the region, fostering war, invading it itself, of course, and essentially bringing about chaos from one end of the region to the other.
Let's go to what you pointed out there, Daniel Lazar, and I'll ask you, Kevin Barrett, about back in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S. was left to be the dominant military power. Why then was there an increase in the military interventions? Why wasn't there a decrease? What led the U.S. towards down that path?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I remember back then that there was a widespread feeling that Americans and the world would be getting a peace dividend. We look forward to a big reduction in government expenditures, big reduction in taxes, and an enhanced civilian economy. And somehow that didn't happen. And I think that the people who profit from these wars, who became part of the national security complex, which is really an imperial kind of bureaucratic and corporate and criminal overlapping set of worlds, that these people profit mightily from war. And they wanted to make sure that those wars continued. So they began pretty half-heartedly in the 1990s with interventions in Eastern Europe and things like that, continuing to rain death on Iraq by killing Iraqi children through sanctions, things like that. But I think they recognized that that wasn't sustainable because of the general tenor of public opinion in the U.S., which has always followed George Washington's dictate that the U.S. should never be involved in foreign quarrels. And indeed, the founding fathers believe there should only be a military that gets called up in the event of the U.S. being attacked and invaded externally, as happened in the War of 1812. Of course, that set of beliefs of the public has never really matched reality very well. But I think they had to change that. And so that's why we got the September 11th, 2001 New Pearl Harbor. That was a false flag event that was modeled after the original Pearl Harbor, which had been the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that was actually orchestrated by an eight-point plan put together by the Roosevelt Brain Trust under supervision of British intelligence. And that the Pearl Harbor scam was used to turn around 80% plus U.S. public opinion against entry into World War II. And suddenly overnight, the entire American public, with a very, very few exceptions, welcomed U.S. Involvement in World War II. And then that mentality continued after the war and allowed for this vastly increased level of militarism. So they did the same thing in 2001. They created a new Pearl Harbor, which indeed the very defense intellectuals who orchestrated this had actually openly yearned for in a September 2000 document called Rebuilding America's Defenses. They basically called for a new Pearl Harbor. And so then they got it when their operatives blew up the World Trade Center with explosives and attacked the Pentagon, blamed it on Muslims, which was completely false. Those 19 guys they blamed were not even on the planes. At least there's no evidence that they were. So that event, that great deception, was used to condition the American public, just as Pearl Harbor conditioned them to believe that they had to go out and try to rule the world in order to not be vulnerable to the surprise attack. The same mentality reigned after September 11th, and Americans became completely irrational, gave up their desire for a peace dividend, gave up whatever remnants of belief in George Washington's foreign policy they had. And so the imperial warmongers were free to double their military budget, to increase their biological warfare budget by 10,000% in the wake of the false flag anthrax attack by the U.S. biodefense sector on the U.S. Congress, and do everything that they've done since then, which is essentially turn the U.S. into the most criminal militaristic dictatorship that's ever existed.
Well, I'd like to find out how we got to that point. And Daniel Lazar, it's hard to really try to follow the way that this transpired. But I'm going to go along the lines of the number of U.S. military bases, which is roughly around 800. Where did this number and how did this number really come about? I mean, you know, you go through year by year, and there's a think tank of some kind, or it's deep inside the Pentagon. Let's have a U.S. base here. Let's have one over there. How does it get to be to the point where there's so many of them and for the U.S. to have the biggest military spending? Or not defense, military spending of around roughly $800 billion. How did the U.S. get to that point?
Well, let me just begin by saying that Kevin Barrett is a friend of mine. I like him very much, but I disagree with him profoundly about Pearl Harbor or 9/11. Pearl Harbor was an attack by the Japanese, and 9/11 was truly an attack by Al-Qaeda's origins are tied up with the U.S. Sponsored war in Afghanistan, but that attack was quite real. It was not carried out by American operatives of any sort. And as for why there are
evidence against those innocent 19 men,
and as why there are 800 bases around the world. Well, after 1991, the U.S. became the global hegemon, and it felt it was its responsibility to patrol the entire globe. And that meant putting into operation a very complicated structure of military domination. And that involved 800 bases or so, give or take 50, around the globe. And the U.S. also set out to outspend the rest of the world. I mean, I think U.S. spending is now it's greater than that of the next 10 nations combined. So the U.S. turned itself into a global military colossus whose purpose is to control the globe, control the earth in a way that is conducive to America's profits, its economic growth, its attempt to further its superpower status.
Let me jump in when you say that, because when you say the U.S. Has all these military bases, which I pose to you as a question, you also said that the U.S. is out to control the world. What right does it give the U.S. through its military to then feel through that it can control the world? I mean, is that the type of thinking? I'm just trying to make sure I'm clear on this.
It gives it no right, of course, no right at all, of course. You're absolutely correct. It's an excellent question. The U.S. has no moral right. It has no legal right under international law. You're correct, but it's a case of might makes right. The U.S. has has this huge military structure, which the rest of the world can't say no to, and therefore it uses it to enforce its will around the globe. Now, the problem today is that a growing number of countries are saying no, such as Russia, Iran, and China. So therefore, that has the U.S. deeply upset and is leading to ever more aggressive actions by the imperial center.
So if might is right, Kevin Barrett, doesn't that go hand in hand with U.S. foreign policy to make these countries where U.S. has military bases, as an example, that, okay, this is our line, and you're either with us or you're with them in a sense, but I'm sorry, that's a quote from somebody else. So is that how it goes, parallel with the U.S. Military bases and defense spending, that the countries need to follow the U.S. foreign policy?
Well, of course, the U.S. has used these military bases and other forms of power to push around the governments of other countries in all sorts of different ways. And one of the ways that we haven't heard much about in the Western media is the history of U.S. nuclear threats against other nations. I have a book somewhere on my bookshelves documenting, I forget precisely how many dozens of such direct threats to use nuclear weapons against other nations. And so this is a kind of bullying and intimidation set tactic. It's a little bit like the mafia with its threats. It's obviously corrupt, and it is about various forms of profiteering. And those forms can be obvious, as is the case of the way that the U.S. military is used to keep the billionaire oligarch elite of the West in a position to continue robbing the world blind and robbing their own societies blind as well. We don't tolerate governments that are strong enough to protect their own citizens, much less anybody else, against the depredations of our neoliberal oligarchs. So that part is obvious. There are also all sorts of other ways that people within and around the so-called military-industrial complex profit from this empire. And one of the biggest and least known by consumers of mainstream media is drug smuggling. That is, that it's not that widely known, unfortunately, that since the late 1940s, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has been by far the world's biggest illegal drug smuggler. And I highly recommend the book on Operation Gladio by, I forget, the former Fox News correspondent of all people who wrote it, that documents how the CIA saw that Chiang Kai-shek had managed to finance his war operations using illegal narcotics money, and that whoever did this was going to have a big edge up in ruling the world. And so the CIA got into that game, and they ended up using the Vatican Bank as their biggest single money laundry. I think a lot of Catholics would be shocked to know this. So there's a lot of criminal profiteering that goes on. It's no coincidence that Vietnam happened right there in the Golden Triangle, where the U.S. was shipping back vast amounts of heroin in the bodies of dead soldiers, in the coffins of dead soldiers. The film Air America documents this. And then it's no coincidence that we went into Afghanistan at a time when the Taliban had shut down the heroin industry. And the first thing that the U.S. forces did was free the drug lords and set them to work. And within 2 years, record profits, record crops were being generated. So there are all sorts of these corrupt ways of profiteering that justify the imperial depredations of the empire. And that's the, I think these are the kinds of real reasons why the U.S. is doing this, not any kind of belief in the superiority of the American system or the need for a rules-based international order and all this nonsense. They're just a bunch of corrupt criminal types who are making money from it, and they want to continue making money.
Okay, since you talked about profits and money, arms sales for the U.S., it has been a top supplier based on SIPRI to West Asia or Middle East, where the U.S. arms export, Daniel Lazar, increased from 32% to 37% over the last 5 years. This being a report from the year 2019, I should mention, with imports by Middle East and North Africa growing by 25%. Well, guess what? The study that we talked about, the topic of this program, reveals that the U.S. has waged these wars, a quarter of them in West Asia and in Africa. Is this a coincidence? And why then is West Asia and Africa the focus?
First, it's not a coincidence. The U.S. pours arms into these regions in order to destabilize them and thereby control them all the more effectively. But the reason is resources. In the case of the Middle East, it's oil. I mean, oil is what capitalism has run on for the last century. It is absolutely crucial to industrial capitalism as it is now constructed. And so therefore, you know, the Middle East has become the great prize. The U.S. has poured, you know, incredible resources, literally trillions of dollars, into militarizing Middle East. And what are the consequences? The consequences of the region has been torn by one major war after the other. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, have been killed. Entire countries have been laid waste, such as Syria and Yemen. Others like Iraq have been destroyed. Iran has been under an economic siege since the 1980s. And meanwhile, the U.S. is arming to the teeth Saudi Arabia, perhaps the most repressive single government on the face of the earth. And the U.S. does this all in the name of democracy. I mean, it's a complete joke. But the effect of all this is to cause living conditions to plummet in these regions.
Well, then let me ask you this, Kevin Barrett. If the U.S. was not to be involved in these militaristic approaches that it has had, i.e. wars, what kind of world would we be living in now? Because right now, Afghanistan is a mess. Iran is being threatened right and left with either through Israel, which is a U.S. ally, not to mention other countries in West Asia, which are either unstable or teetering on it, such as Syria. We're looking at the U.S., Ukraine, conflict. I'm sorry, it's the Russia-Ukraine conflict, but the U.S. obviously is in there somewhere. And then you have China, and we're seeing what's happening there. But what if the U.S. wasn't involved at all? What kind of world would we be living in now?
Well, there are a lot of indications that it would be much more peaceful and prosperous, certainly in West Asia. If we look at what the U.S. has done to whom and why, what we see over and over is the same pattern, that when a country starts becoming reasonably prosperous because its leadership is putting the interests of its own people first, that's when the U.S. attacks. That's what we did to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. For all of his many faults and crimes, Saddam Hussein had basically eliminated corruption from that country, except within his own family, of course, and had built the living standards, the infrastructure, and the educational levels up to near first world levels. And that's why Iraq had to be destroyed. And likewise with Gaddafi in Libya, who had brought Libya into the 21st century as by far the most prosperous country in Africa. And that's why Libya had to be destroyed as well. Iran has been a surprising success economically, despite the incredible sanctions and the opposition of so much of the world ever since the 1979 revolution. Still, Iran has done reasonably well, and that's why Iran is still facing so much hostility. And then if we look at just what happened in Pakistan, Imran Khan had actually presided over an incredibly successful couple of years where the economic growth shot up to 6-7%. Because Imran Khan was following policies that would benefit the Pakistani people by trading with partners like China that are interested in trade rather than just depredation. And so the U.S. overthrew Imran Khan's government, as it always overthrows and targets governments that put the best interests of their own people first. So if we didn't have this U.S. empire destroying countries and overthrowing governments that are, in fact, working on behalf of their people, we would probably have a much more peaceful and prosperous planet. All of that money that's being wasted in death and destruction would be saved, and the world would be much better off.
Well, this is what the U.S. has said, Daniel Lazar, and I'm going to read off a particular organization that I'm going to ask you who you think has released this, where it says, as a title, the U.S. strategy to prevent conflict and to promote stability, priority countries and region. The U.S. government is moving forward in the spirit of partnership with countries and a regional grouping of countries to implement the 10-year U.S. strategy to prevent conflict and to promote stability. Can you guess what organization has actually stated that?
I would suggest the National Security Council.
USAID.
USAID.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah,
from the American classic people. So they're using this organization, and this is their line, but we know that USAID has been involved in regime change operations in Cuba, in Russia, and perhaps elsewhere. Cuba and Russia distinctly stand out.
Yes. But this is the way America works. I mean, America sees itself as the font of justice and rightness. Everything America does is by definition right. Even when America makes mistakes, it's because it's too good. It's trying too hard to make the world a better place. So occasionally it oversteps. But in general, the fundamental assumption across the entire political spectrum, across the entire corporate press, is that America is good, it is just, it is correct. It is a country that is trying its best to make the world a better place. And so therefore, yes, when it wages war, it's really trying to wage peace. And it's only because other countries oppose its peacemaking efforts that war results. I mean, it's completely narcissistic reasoning, but that is how America works. That is the basic mental function of U.S. society in general.
All right. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. I'm going to thank our guests. Thank you for your input there, Daniel Lazar, journalist and author from New York. Kevin Barrett, thank you so much, editor at Veterans Today, who spoke to us from Madison. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Tavway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم قال لمن حوله ألا تستمعون
Pharaoh said to those around him, Do you not hear?
قال ربكم ورب آبائكم الأولين
Moses said, Your Lord and the Lord of your first forefathers.
As you were previously with us, dear listeners, we have reached the 25th verse of chapter Shu'ara. قَالَ لِمَنْ حَوْلَهُ أَلَا تَسْتَمِعُونَ قَالَ رَبُّكُمْ وَرَبُّ آبَائِكُمُ الْأَوَّلِينَ In the previous episodes, we discussed some of the story of Prophet Moses against Pharaoh. In the palace of Pharaoh to invite him to monotheism, to believe in the Lord of the worlds and to accept his lordship, to worship him and to believe in the fact that he is the manager of the world. But in response to that, Fir'aun says, قَالَ فِرْعَوْنُ وَمَا رَبُّ الْعَالَمِينَ What is the Lord of the worlds? And Prophet Moses answers him back, قَالَ رَبُّ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا إِن كُنْتُم مُؤْمِنِينَ If you truly have faith, you can open your eyes, you can see the heavens and the earth, you can see the system in this creation, and you can see what is between the heavens and the earth. They are all created by Him, if you truly believe. إِن كُنْتُم مُؤْمِنِينَ If you have faith, you will believe in Him. You can truly realize Him. But Pharaoh did not want to wake up from ignorance, sleep. And even with these words of heavenly great teacher, he continues ridiculing and scoffing. He used the ancient method of the conceited tyrants and addressed his companions when he spoke, as the Holy Quran says, قَالَ لِمَنْ حَوْلَهُ أَلَا تَسْتَمِعُونَ Pharaoh said to those around him, Do you not hear what he says? So, لِمَنْ حَوْلَهُ To those people around him, it is obvious who were the companions of Pharaoh. They were some people like Pharaoh himself. They were some oppressors and wealthy people who only supported tyranny, who only used to gather around what benefits them. Ibn Abbas says that his companions who were attending there were 500 people who were some special and important persons of his nation. Now, what is his aim? What is he meaning to do by this word, أَلَا تَسْتَمِعُونَ Do you not listen to him? Pharaoh's aim is to render this logical and pleasant speech of Moses ineffective on the dark heart of group. He wants to show that this speech is meaningless, its content is not understandable, so that is why he goes on and says, أَلَا تَسْتَمِعُونَ Do you not listen to him?
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء لي الدنيا We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So when Moses introduces the Lord of the heavens and the earth and what is between them, even with this logical statement, Pharaoh does not want to wake up from the sleep of ignorance. He continues ridiculing this argument and says, أَلَا تَسْتَمِعُونَ? So he is looking forward to render this speech meaningless. But Moses continues this logical and calculated words, and he fears no one. He goes on and says, as the Holy Quran states, قَالَ رَبُّكُمْ وَرَبُّ آبَائِكُمُ الْأَوَّلِينَ. Moses said, your Lord and the Lord of your fathers of old. As a matter of fact, Moses, who began with the extrovertive signs in the first stage, then in the second stage of introducing Allah, proceeds to introvertive signs. He embarked on mysteries of creation in man himself, and the signs of Allah's lordship in soul and body of man. But why? He wants to make these ignorant, conceited people think about themselves. He wants to make them get to know themselves a little bit and then to know the Lord of the worlds. Because he, the Prophet, knows that through understanding yourself, it is that you understand Allah more. It is the embodiment of the word من عرف نفسه فقد عرف ربه. The one who understands himself has understood and recognized truly the Lord. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc. You wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine activists marched through central Vienna on Friday to vent their anger following Israel's recent bombardment of Gaza. They joined thousands of other protesters worldwide who were shocked into action after the three-day Israeli offensive left over 350 Palestinians wounded, 46 dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials.
Following the recent violence against Gaza, shocking images of children suffering and dying went absolutely viral on social media. Yet despite these disturbing images doing the rounds, they haven't been routinely featured in Western mainstream media circles. In fact, it's incredibly rare for any images of Palestinian suffering to be published at all.
They are suffering every day, every single day. People got arrested, children got arrested, people got murdered. Gaza, what we saw last week in three, 4 days, got bombed. They have no electricity, they have no way to go anywhere. They are blocked from the Israeli occupation.
I need to tell my people that we are standing up for them. We are resisting from abroad. So you have to stay strong. And I'm an artist, so it is a duty for me to raise the voice for the ones who are not heard.
We need to raise our voice, and Austria cooperates with Israel. And that's what we are doing here also is that we want to make people aware of this, that Austria is cooperating with Israel.
Despite regular condemnation of Israeli aggression by human rights groups, Palestinians continue to suffer while the Western world looks on, leaving few options left for Palestinians driven to fight for their very survival. Robert Carter, Vienna.
In mid-August last year, the Taliban took control of Afghanistan and the Western-backed government collapsed. On its anniversary, the Afghan people have not forgotten what they went through during this period. Economic collapse triggered by the U.S. seizure of nearly $9 billion in Afghan assets and cuts in global aid has been one of their main struggles. Afghans lived through a harsh winter with little food. Based on a poll by Gallup Institute, nearly all Afghans rated their lives as poorly enough to be considered suffering. Meanwhile, some neighboring countries and international bodies rushed aid to the country.
We witnessed that after the Taliban takeover, people sold their children and body organs to put food on the table. I personally lost my job and have been unemployed for months. Millions of others were unable to make ends meet due to food and cash scarcity. I urge the U.S. and the international community to release frozen Afghan funds and let the flow of aid. Afghans can no longer bear the ongoing miseries.
The security situation in the meantime has been far better than in the past 2 decades. That's to say, people experienced less violence and conflict this year. However, the occasional attacks by the Daesh terrorist group continue to haunt the community.
Previously, our people were living with the U.S. bombardments on their territories. Under the pretext of the war against terror, the U.S. pushed terror in Afghanistan for 20 years and violated all rights of Afghans. Since the Taliban have come to power, our country has been more secure and peaceful. I hope the Taliban succeed in cracking down on Daesh terrorist group and tightening security for all.
The Taliban, on the other hand, failed to gain international recognition. Afghans and the global community have criticized the Taliban for not forming an all-inclusive government.
This week marks the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover. To date, the Taliban have been unable to form a government representing all walks of Afghan society and protect their rights. In Afghanistan's history, no government has been successful without securing national legitimacy and being inclusive. The Taliban should learn from the past, seek fair engagement with Afghans, and be flexible against the global community.
All things considered, international bodies and rights groups continue to engage with the de facto Taliban to advocate for the rights of Afghans and address their needs. They also have been calling on the Taliban to open girls' school as soon as possible. 1 year into the Taliban government, Afghans are calling on the international community to help the country's economy and force the U.S. to release its frozen assets. At the same time, they said the new government should engage more in diplomacy with other countries to improve the situation in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
As Israel's systematic attacks on Gaza and Al-Quds persist, another war continues to rage on in Europe. The battle pits pro-Palestine activists pushing a global anti-Israel boycott campaign versus local authorities who back ties with Israel. Founded in 2005, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, also known as BDS, is a Palestinian-led movement promoting economic sanctions on Israel. Due to the movement's popularity, Tel Aviv has lobbied European lawmakers to criminalize the group and its activities. France, Germany and Britain are key battlegrounds, but lesser known is the struggles of the BDS in Austria. Speaking to local members, a crackdown on BDS activism remains ongoing.
It started in 2018 when, the local city government of Vienna, they implemented city resolutions, for example, against the BDS movement, where they say all local institutions and governmental institutions are not allowed anymore to support the movement, so which means all public places, they are restricted for us. All these restrictions against the BDS movement in Austria, in Europe and worldwide, I think it's a reaction from the Zionist movement and from the Zionist lobby, because BDS is getting stronger and stronger.
The Vienna city government are currently suing a BDS Austria representative over a Facebook post showing an image plastered over an official city poster. Elsewhere, support for the BDS can get you labelled anti-Semitic due to Austria adopting the controversial IHRA definition on anti-Semitism.
European authorities are introducing new legislation which aims to stop the activities of the peaceful boycott campaign. But policing people's desires not to invest in the Israeli regime is proving a near impossible task. Speaking to representatives of the BDS here in Vienna, they say that the response is an inevitable backlash to the group's success in undermining and damaging Israel's reputation across the continent. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Turkey's Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu says he had a side talk with Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad on the sidelines of the Non-Aligned Movement Summit in October last year. The Turkish minister added he suggested a reconciliation to take place between the Syrian government and the opposition, noting that without such a step, Syria will continue to face a crisis. Cavusoglu said that the EU and the international community would support a ceasefire in the war-torn country, and that no country would help in Syria's rebuild the process if a ceasefire is not achieved.
To prevent the division of Syria, there must be a strong administration in Syria. The will that can dominate every corner of its lands can only be achieved through unity and solidarity. We need to bring the opposition and government together for reconciliation. There will be no permanent peace otherwise.
Some believe such a revelation is a signal indicating Turkey is preparing for its cross-border military operation in northern Syria. In recent weeks, the Turkish army has been sending reinforcements to northern Syria near the town of Tel Rifat. The town is under the control of Kurdish YPG forces, a U.S.-backed militia that Turkey considers the armed wing of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as PKK.
I think the timing of this announcement comes as Turkey is preparing for a cross-border military operation to secure the border area and push back Kurdish forces. A reconciliation between the government and the opposition will not only bring peace to Syria, but also Turkey, a country that has been directly affected by the Syrian war from terrorist attacks to the refugee crisis.
Some analysts believe Turkey has long been serving its own agenda in Syria. For example, by supporting some opposition groups inside Syria who served Ankara's interest in securing its borders and pushing Kurdish forces back. It might be soon to say whether Ankara has changed its strategy in regards with Syria. What is clear for Turkey is that fighting or defeating the Kurdish militants cannot guarantee its security. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Gas bills in Italy will likely double in cost from October the 1st if gas prices continue to rise this way. The recent announcement by power regulator ARERA has gone utterly unnoticed, with Italian media focusing on the electoral campaign about a month away from the September 25 national elections. A week ago, the outgoing Italian government unveiled a 17 billion euros aid package aimed at protecting families from surging energy costs and rising consumer prices. However, ARERA and some energy experts have warned that very little has been done so far to reduce energy consumption in the country.
Italy's highly critical energy situation has been downplayed by politicians and the media. On one side, there is confidence about the country achieving its target of reaching storage levels of 90%, while on the other side, the risk that Russia could altogether stop the flow of gas to Italy has been underplayed.
Gas is central to Italy's energy systems. The country even produces over 50% of its electricity from natural gas. Rome has cut its reliance on Russian gas imports to 25% from about 40% at the start of the year, a decision that has thrown the energy sector into uncertainty. Some analysts have predicted annual gas bills could reach an average of 1,800 euros next year, almost double the annual average of 950 euros recorded this year. Many Italians are simply bewildered about how they can find themselves in a position of not being able to heat or light their homes.
It's been this way forever. I used to be a unionist. I saw the crisis coming. This is how our country works. We don't have any sovereignty.
Nothing works in this country. We have forever been in the hands of a bunch of swindlers and criminals. Italy has no future.
The outgoing government is planning to offset its dependence on Russian gas by signing new deals with African and Eastern Mediterranean countries and building new regasification plants in a number of Italian sea towns, a move that has met with staunch opposition from local residents. Max Civili, Rome.
Rights groups have accused the Israeli regime of committing war crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip during its three-day onslaught against the territory. On Friday, Israeli forces started launching wanton attacks on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of civilians, including women and children. The fighting stopped on Sunday through an Egypt-mediated ceasefire. But Palestinians now have to live with the devastating aftermath of Israeli attacks. According to Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians were systematic and deliberate and fall under Israel's strategy of using disproportionate and excessive force against civilians.
Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights reiterates its strongest condemnation of Israel's gross and systematic violations of international law, particularly in cases of extrajudicial killings and attacks against civilians and civilian objects. Such violations amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity for which those responsible must be held accountable.
five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008. The regime has been using U.S.-made warplanes and weapons to hit targets in the densely populated area.
The United States and Israel are both responsible for the bloodshed in Gaza. Israel was given the green light from the United States to carry out the brutal attacks on Gaza under the watchful eye of the international community. Israel and the United States are partners in crime against the Palestinian people.
Human rights organizations say, based on the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, it is more than clear that Israel has been committing war crimes during its attacks on Gaza.
The impunity Israel continues to enjoy and the absence of accountability encourage Israeli officials to continue perpetuating war crimes against Palestinians. As evidenced by its latest aggression on Gaza, Israel does not hesitate to engage in prohibited acts of killing, including direct targeting of civilians. The International Criminal Court must at least investigate these crimes.
For decades now, there has been no pressure on Israel to stop its violence against civilians. Despite repeated and desperate pleas from human rights groups, the international community has stayed silent about the regime's atrocities against Palestinians.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Now, rights groups are demanding that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Tragedy, injustice, and destruction prompted a group of London rights organizations to call an emergency demonstration in support of Palestine and Palestinians. The Israeli bombardment of Gaza was the worst it's been since the May 2021 war that killed 260 Palestinians and destroyed thousands of homes and businesses. This new assault cost the lives of at least 47 Palestinians. A third of the scores killed were children. For those attending the demonstration opposite Downing Street, the official residence of the British Prime Minister, they needed to be present to raise their voice against the injustice.
What we've witnessed over the last few days is very familiar, but no less horrific. Once again, Israel has been bombing the Palestinian people in Gaza, claiming a right to self-defense. There's a reality here that any form of violence that is used to enforce occupation, used to enforce apartheid, used to enforce settler colonialism is by definition illegitimate. It is the Palestinian people who have a right to defense and to protect themselves.
One of the main themes linking the speakers at this event is the fact that the Israeli aggression is only made possible by the tacit support of states like the British, and that Palestinian blood remains on British hands.
The UK has obligations under international humanitarian law and the Geneva Convention to look after the people who are occupied rather than stand with the oppressor, with the world's 21st century apartheid state. They must stop. They must support the Palestinians in real terms, not through words, two-state solution, which means absolutely nothing, but in sanctioning Israel, because that's the next thing that needs to happen.
Your policy on the Palestinians has to change. Justice has to prevail. And the way the hypocrisy, the way they do deal with the Palestinian issue and other issues like the Ukrainian issues, for example, is at least we can say a hypocritical way of dealing with it. So therefore, we are here today to raise our voice and tell them that this is not acceptable.
Though a ceasefire is supposed to be in force, commentators point out that this simply means Israel has moved its campaign of aggression to other parts of occupied Palestine, including Nablus, where there have already been casualties, raising the specter of an escalation resulting in further Palestinian blood being shed. Amina Taylor, London.
Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference on the dire situation of Yemeni children amid the years-long Saudi war on the country. The ministry has criticized the United Nations for its inaction on Saudi atrocities.
When the United Nations removed Saudi Arabia from the list of violators of children's rights, it encouraged the kingdom to continue killing Yemeni children and targeting service facilities for children such as schools, hospitals and health centers. It also prevented the entry of humanitarian and medical aid for children. We know that there are UN reports that talk about the spread of malnutrition amongst children, along with many chronic diseases that need care. But unfortunately, there is no real action to save the children of Yemen.
Officials say the UN has collaborated with the Saudi led coalition in killing Yemeni children by providing political cover up for Riyadh's violations. Moreover, the world body removed the kingdom from the list of groups accused of violating children's rights.
The United Nations is a clear and prominent partner in the aggressive war on Yemen, and we have in the 8 years of war clear evidence that the United Nations participated in all the crimes committed against the Yemenis and did not condemn Saudi Arabia for its crimes, but rather the victims bear everything the executioner does. The United Nations has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children through its silence and coverage of Saudi crimes. It has also removed Saudi Arabia 5 times from the list of violators of children's rights.
According to human rights groups, more than 9,000 children have been killed or maimed by Saudi airstrikes since the beginning of the war in 2015. Health officials say more than 1 million children are suffering from malnutrition, one of the highest numbers in the world.
Human rights activists say the United Nations is hostage to Saudi Arabia's funding for its programs. They say the world body has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children because of its silence on Saudi crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his movement and his revolution and how it is related to human rights. So we started looking at Imam Hussein's revolution from the beginning, and we go to the part where Imam Hussein decided to leave Mecca towards Iraq. Now, as Imam Hussein alayhi salam is leaving Mecca towards Iraq, halfway, Yazid sent an army of 1,000 by the command of Al-Hurr ibn Yazid al-Riyahi to intercept Imam Hussein from reaching Kufa or reaching Iraq. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he himself was very well equipped in terms of having water, having everything. They were, you know, they have their affairs in order. That 1,000 people, this army that was meant to intercept Imam Hussein, they weren't that prepared, and they had to go through the desert, and they had lack of water. By the time they got to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they were extremely thirsty to the point of dying of thirst, them and their horses, their mules. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he could have used that for his advantage. He could have made them die out of thirst, and they will not be able to harm him or his family or intercept him from reaching his destination. He could have easily done that, and he could have justified it as well. He said, well, they're my enemies. They're here to kill me. So I have the right to defend myself, and I have the right not to give them water. But here's what Imam Hussein alayhi salam did. He fed every one of them water. He crunched the thirst. Not just them, but even their horses. To such an extent that he used to feed some of the horses with his own bare holy hands. That one person came very late and he was extremely thirsty. And the Imam fed him water himself, and he fed his horse water himself. That same person on the battlefield on the 10th of Ashura, when Imam Hussein was asking them for water, this same person who Imam Hussein gave water to him and to his horse, he said to Imam Hussein, "You will not drink water until you die of thirst." Anyway, let's not jump ahead of ourselves. The idea here is that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he looked at this situation as a human right situation,